Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about the extent to which Senators Obama and McCain appear to be squaring off against each other, to some extent making Hillary Clinton irrelevant. John McCain, of course, his campaign, according to Sunday's New York Times, is in disarray. And the reformer, the candidate who is running as a reformer, finds himself having to apologize for having so many lobbyists on his campaign staff. We'll be talking with Cliff Schechter, who's a veteran campaign strategist, syndicated columnist, and political commentator. His work has been featured in a variety of publications, including the Miami Herald, the American Prospect, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and others. He was a pollster for the successful re-election of Bill Clinton in 1996. And he's written a book about John McCain. The new book is called The Real McCain, Why Conservatives Don't Trust Him and Why Independents Shouldn't. So we'll be talking to Cliff Schechter about the race and about John McCain's apparent problems. Then we'll talk about the Pentagon audit that was came out this week, where the Pentagon audited Army spending. $8.2 billion was audited, 90% of which was missing, sometimes with vast amounts, millions of dollars allocated on the basis of a receipt that's simply a piece of paper with something illegible written on it. It's an extraordinary story, and we were talking to Winslow Wheeler, who worked in national security issues for 31 years as a member of the U.S. Senate and for the United States General Accounting Office. In 2002, Winslow Wheeler authored an essay under the pseudonym Spartacus about Congress's reaction to September 11, 2001, terrorist attack entitled Mr. Smith is Dead. No one stands in the way as Congress lards post September 11th defense bills with pork. And when senators complained about Wheeler's criticism, he was invited to resign from his position with the Republican staff of the Senate Budget Committee. He is now a senior fellow and director of the Status Military Reform Project at the Center for Defense Information in Washington, D.C. And Winslow Wheeler is the author of The Wastrels of Defense, How Congress Sabotages U.S. Security. Then on this Memorial Day weekend, we'll be joined by a Iraq veteran, Liam Madden. He's on the board of Iraq Vets Against the War, and he's co-founder of a group called Appeal for Redress, which is a way for individual service members to appeal to their congressional representatives and U.S. senators, urging them to end U.S. military occupation of Iraq. He left the military in January. Let's now begin with Cliff Schechter, veteran campaign strategist, syndicated columnist. He worked as a pollster for the successful re-election of Bill Clinton in 1996, and is the author of a new book, The Real McCain, Why Conservatives Don't Trust Him and Why Independents Shouldn't. And, of course, Sunday's New York Times has a leading front-page article, Worries in GOP About Disarray in McCain's Camp. Apparently the concern amongst Republican strategists is the candidate who's running as a reformer is now under the microscope and in getting negative press about the extent to which his key campaign staff, these top staff members, are in fact lobbyists. Do you think that Charlie Black is going to be also make an exit, since others have? Charlie Black, of course, is getting roasted by MoveOn.org. I don't know whether you've seen, Cliff, the ads that they put out.
Yeah, I have. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. Yeah, Charlie Black is being roasted quite he deserves it, quite frankly. The list of people he's lobbied for, both domestically and internationally, is quite a list, from Mobutu Sese Seko of Zaire to Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines to Big Tobacco here. But that's what's so disingenuous, quite frankly, about this supposed form that everybody's filling out in the McCain campaign, where they get to all, you know, list what their conflicts of interest are, because the guys who are giving out this form, Charlie Black and then also McCain's campaign manager, Rick Davis, are lobbyists themselves and have lobbied as recently as a few years ago. Charlie Black, in fact, lobbied from the back of the campaign bus So he was talking to his clients. So it just rings hollow. There's 115 of these guys that are registered lobbyists that are either on the campaign or bundling money, meaning they're raising these large sums through their contacts, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so to think that McCain wouldn't be affected by this is to live in a fantasy world, which I guess is the same fantasy world McCain's people live in when they say that he doesn't have any conflicts of interest, because it's unbelievable.
So how long do you think this image of the maverick is going to stand up to this scrutiny? Last Sunday, we had a true maverick on, Senator Lincoln Chafee, a Republican senator who was the only Republican to vote against authorizing the Iraq War. And, of course, he paid a price for that. But you get the feeling that, sometimes in U.S. politics, particularly on the right, it doesn't matter if you're an authentic hero or not. John Wayne never served in the military, and neither did Ronald Reagan. But,
no, but
they
are
icons of patriotism to the right wing.
Well, the sad thing on the right wing is if you look good in a cowboy hat, that's enough to turn you into a hero for them. In the case of McCain, at least he did serve abroad, unlike Reagan and unlike Wayne and most of the other Republican leadership, from Tom DeLay to Mitch McConnell, who, of course, are quick to question others' patriotism.
Not to mention the vice president, of course.
Yeah, who got 5 deferments because he was, quote, had other things to do.
Other priorities,
that's correct. My mistake. And, yeah, I'm sure nobody else did. I think it's been damaged somewhat, and thankfully the media is now picking up on this. I talk a lot in The Real McCain. I have 2 full chapters that run down the many lobbyists and other connections that are in McCain's campaign. I mean, the list is from people, crooked businessmen to white supremacists. It's quite a rogues gallery, and I'm glad the media is finally asking these questions. These aren't people like in Obama's case where they kept talking endlessly about Jeremiah Wright, a guy, a pastor, the church he attended. These are people whose endorsements McCain has sought, as you talked about Hagee and Parsley a short while ago. They're people he sought these people's endorsements. He's actively had gotten political advice from them. They've served on his campaign. One of his top advisors, National Finance Chair Tom Loeffler, who just stepped down last week, was lobbying for Saudi Arabia. His firm took in $8 million in 1 year's time, a few years after 9/11, when we were trying to get answers to why 15 of 19 hijackers came from Saudi Arabia on those airplanes, why a bunch of the financial elites there were still giving money to Al-Qaeda, were never being questioned for it. This is deadly serious stuff, and yet... For a while, McCain was able to avoid scrutiny. Now, thankfully, it really does look like the media is starting to sort of scratch their heads, many members of the media, and say, how have we given this guy such a free pass? I only hope it'll continue, because in the past, he's been able to invite them over for a good round of barbecue at the Sedona Ranch, and the questions stopped getting asked.
Well, of course, this weekend, he is barbecuing for a group of Republicans, many of whom appear to be possible vice president contenders on his ticket. Mitt Romney, of course, being, I think, the most likely one to get that job. What do you think of this weekend barbecue that's going on?
Well, I can understand why you'd want Mitt Romney there. Mitt Romney may be the only person that can make John McCain actually look like a straight talker. I'm not convinced there's one position Mitt Romney held in 2002 when he ran for governor of Massachusetts that he still holds. A guy that ran, as somebody who was going to be better on gay rights than Teddy Kennedy, and also had been pro-choice since Roe versus Wade was established and his mother had fought in that fight. These were things that he had to say when he was debating Teddy Kennedy and ran for the Senate in 1994. So he would fit perfectly in with John McCain's ticket as the no-principle ticket of guys who will say whatever it takes to get elected. In terms of Charlie Crist, who's the governor of Florida, he would help in some ways in that, obviously, he seems to be very popular in Florida, but there's some questions about him that make him not too popular among the conservative base. Let's see, who's the third one? I'm not even remembering there.
Well, there's Joe Lieberman, who's obviously angling for some kind of a job with McCain, and I think if the Democrats pick up the majority that they're likely to get in the Senate, he mercifully will not have the power that he has now, since he's the swing vote.
Yeah, I think that's definitively true, and I think he also realized that he snookered a large number of Connecticut Democrats into thinking that he still actually was a Democrat, and in fact lied to their faces and said that one of the reasons he wanted to go back was to fight for a Democratic president to get elected. go back to the Senate when he had a tough primary in 2006 and then ran as an independent Democrat, in quotes. So right. Lieberman's another one who's been completely disingenuous, so he fits in well there, too.
And Lindsey Graham is, of course, the other senator that's a friend of McCain's and a possible running mate.
Yeah, these are all guys that go wherever the political winds blow. I found what you said very interesting before. You talked about Winslow Wheeler, who I interviewed for my book, and there's a guy who's a true maverick and a true hero who was terrific and was willing to speak to me on the record, you know, when he was let go from his Senate job, as you said, after almost 30 years there on the Hill and working for Republicans, mind you. He actually challenged John McCain on pork, other Republicans too, but he challenged John McCain by name and said, you're not really doing anything to cut pork, this wasteful spending, and then, of course, he lost his job for it. There's a guy that was willing to lose his job to stand up for his principles and actually take on his own party. That's a guy that should get the credit, not the John McCains of the world who are willing to go wherever the political winds blow them. So just thought I would add that because I heard you mention Winslow, and he's a terrific guy.
Yeah, he's coming up after you to talk about the extraordinary revelations this week of a Pentagon audit of Army spending, where $8.2 billion of American taxpayer money spent by the United States Army on contracts in Iraq, 90% of it essentially disappeared without any real receipts attached.
Which is amazing, and the hearings have been few and far between. Additionally, a big story came out in the Washington Post, thankfully along the lines of what Winslow Wheeler, what he actually said and what he wrote, and what he spoke out about, which is, you know, McCain is now claiming that he can cut $100 billion of pork to balance the budget, which is just absolutely insanity. Top person, Brian Riedel, who's over at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank, mind you, has said that it would be $9 billion at best. So McCain's sitting there inflating the spending he can cut by about 1,000% so that he can go and cut taxes further for corporations, as he said he will do, because I guess when Exxon made $10 billion the first quarter of this year, that wasn't quite enough money. So corporate taxes need to go lower. This is, mind you, while McCain is voting against the GI Bill for veterans to get the educational benefits they deserve for serving this country, voting against S-CHIP so that poorer children can have health care, voting to eliminate the minimum wage so that more people will fall into poverty. Yet he can do all of that and decides that corporations need to have these huge tax cuts and that individual, very wealthy Americans need to have these huge tax cuts. So he has to make up stories about pork that he can cut, which doesn't exist. So I think that's another pertinent thing I hope Winslow will talk about with you.
Well, by the way, I forgot to mention Bobby Jindal, the new governor from Louisiana, who's also down there at the barbecue in Sedona. Another possibility.
That's right. He's the third one I forgot.
On the VP. Well, a listener called in and reminded us of that. How does John McCain, though, navigate he seems to me that his conundrum is that he is considered by a lot of conservatives and evangelicals to be a liberal, and he's obviously been abject in his efforts to appeal to evangelicals by groveling to people he previously denounced, like Robinson and Falwell, and then, of course, he sought Hagee's endorsement, and now that's blown up in his face. But the long and short of it, a lot of conservatives think he's a liberal. He's actually very conservative, and his record indicates that. So both he and if he chooses Romney have had to sort of go after the conservatives to reassure them. At the same time, they have to move back to the center and present their credentials as being mavericks and reformers. So it seems to me that McCain's damned if he does and damned if he doesn't.
Yeah, that's actually pretty accurate. I think just the Republican Party is a very difficult place, and you can see when they're losing seats in the congressional seats in Mississippi and Louisiana, and parts of the country where normally they would win very easily. The brand is very damaged, as it should be, with, as you just brought up, all sorts of money disappearing in Iraq and the way Hurricane Katrina was handled, but just the downright corruption that's gone on. And it's not to say there hasn't been any in the Democratic Party, because there has been, but it's overwhelmingly been in the Republican Party, and overwhelmingly they've showed the American people after 12 years you know, running Congress in 6 years along with President Bush, that all we got out of it was a ton of scandal and huge budget deficits and a war based upon lies that weakened us, didn't strengthen us, and hurt our cause in defeating al-Qaeda, the actual people that attacked us. So McCain's in a difficult place, because the truth of the matter is that if you've seen these recent primaries, everybody keeps bringing up what's going on with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. But John McCain is already the nominee of the party, but he hasn't been granted that status, and it won't until the convention, but everybody knows he is, and he still has consistently only been getting between 72 and about 78% of the Republican vote. There's a good 25%, a quarter of his party, assuming these are conservatives, that are voting against him in protest, which is interesting, as you bring up, because his record is that of a very right-wing conservative, save a couple years in the early 2000s when he was positioning himself to run as an independent for president, and he tried to moderate himself. For the most part, he's been very right-wing. So he's kind of caught in a weird place, because he is very conservative, but conservatives don't seem to believe it. And so he has to go and ask for endorsements from people like Parsley and Hagee on the very far right. And then, of course, when it comes out that they say that Hitler was doing God's work, he has to reject their endorsements. And then he angers conservatives further. I mean, Parsley last night in an article in the Columbus Dispatch reported that he's now withdrawn his endorsement. And so in an important state like Ohio, where Parsley holds sway among evangelicals, there may be some backlash from that. So in a way, you're right. I mean, but it's the problem with John McCain's party. And he could have stood up like, to give credit where it's due, someone like people like Lincoln Chafee and Winslow Wheeler that have left the Republican Party now. He could have done that in an act of showing what he believed, and Jim Jeffords and many others who couldn't believe where the party was headed. Mm-hmm. And he could have run as an independent, or he approached John Kerry in 2004 about joining his ticket. He could have done that. He chose his path, and so he's going to have to live with it.
So, again, Cliff Schechter, what do you think is how successful his strategy will be? We've talked about how he's trying to win over the conservatives who consider him a liberal. What about liberals who consider him a liberal? The Huffington Post ran a piece recently about a sort of tell-all dinner that McCain had some time back, where he said that he didn't vote for Bush in 2000. That seems to play against the very idea that, which is certainly Senator Obama's strategy, to paint McCain as Bush 3. If it turns out that McCain didn't vote for Bush, then that helps assuage liberals that you can, or independents, that you can vote for him. He's not really as bad as you think.
Right.
So it seems to me that was pretty counterintuitive.
It was, and that's the danger of that. And I still don't take any, you know, credit to Arianna Huffington broke that story in her book. He actually had a conversation with her where he told her that in 2000. But people need to understand that was McCain's anger. That wasn't McCain being a maverick. In other words, it was his temper, where he essentially refused to vote for Bush because he was angry with him. And that's the reason why he took a lot of the positions he took, was just to kind of be a thorn in Bush's side. And people need to ask themselves, is that leadership? You know, I mean, I happen to think President Bush was wrong about 90% of the time, but if McCain's record indicates that earlier in his career on social issues and many other areas he agreed with President Bush's strategy, you would expect him to vote that way. And the truth is that, as I try to break down in the real McCain in the book, it seems to me that anger and sort of vindictiveness is the first thing that decides how McCain votes, and the second one, of course, is his political ambition. So ambition, in the end, often will trump the vindictiveness, as it did with Bush and Rove and Jerry Falwell, and even three people that McCain wasn't speaking to after the 2000 election who came to be close buddies again. And Rove, of course, is now unofficially advising McCain's campaign. So people need to know who the real John McCain is to understand that he is very conservative, and just because he did some things that looked moderate, he did those things not out of principle for the most part. I mean, there may be a few exceptions, but for the most part, he did those things because he happened to be angry at somebody at the time, or he was politically positioning himself as he was to run as an independent in 2004, or both. Mm-hmm. You know, because often those things coincided. But it was not about the fact that he's really a moderate. He's not. And again, all you need to do is look at his votes. Look at how he says he wants to put another Alito on the court so we can lose environmental protection. Women will lose control over their bodies. And a variety of other issues. Consumers will lose the right. If I buy a toy for my kids that's got lead in it, we'll have no right to sue. The caveat emptor is what he wants to take us back to. You know, that's just the Supreme Court. And you look at the rest of his record, whether it's extending tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, unbalancing our budget even further and building up debt, extending the war in Iraq for 100 years. You know, where people need to ask themselves, where is that moderation? And I can't, or where's the maverick? Where's the straight talker? And I can't find it anywhere.
Well, just in closing, Cliff Schechter, you worked as a pollster for the successful re-election of Bill Clinton in 1996. You must have some thoughts about what's happening to Hillary Clinton. I must say that the remarks that she made before the editorial board of a paper in South Dakota were blown out of proportion, I think. And I noticed that on MSNBC, Keith Olbermann went completely nuts over it. And it maybe it's the voracious nature of cable TV that they've got to keep ginning up something to talk about. But it seems to me that she's been quite devastated by this, and I don't know why she's still hanging in there, because she's taking a hell of a beating.
Yeah, well, my analysis of the situation is I don't think she was trying to specifically say that Obama might, you know, something bad might happen to him. At the same time, obviously, when you've got people listening to you all the time, you've got to be very careful what you say. From an objective and analyst opinion, I would say that comment has gotten her in a lot of trouble. From my position right now, I don't understand what the end game is for her, and I think at this point it's destructive to the Democratic Party. It's certainly not helpful. I have a lot of respect for Hillary Clinton, but you know, right now the math isn't with her. She can't win the delegates. The superdelegates, or another one from Alaska, went to her today. They keep going to Obama. I'm just not sure what she thinks that she's achieving, because I can't see them overturning the will of the people. So I wish that if she understands how dangerous John McCain is, which I hope she does, that she would join the person who is obviously going to be the nominee in Barack Obama. And, you know, let's get this thing going and make sure the whole country knows how dangerous a McCain presidency would be. That would be my hope.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the interview.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Cliff Schechter, veteran campaign strategist, syndicated columnist, and he has served as a pollster on the successful re-election of Bill Clinton in 1996, and he's the author of a new book about John McCain, the real McCain, why conservatives don't trust him and why independents shouldn't. I'm now speaking with Winslow Wheeler, who worked on national security issues for 31 years for members of the United States Senate and for the U.S. General Accounting Office. In 2002, Winslow Wheeler authored an essay under the pseudonym Spartacus about Congress's reaction to September the 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks, entitled "Mr. Smith is Dead, No One Stands in the Way as Congress lards post September 11 defense bills with pork." When senators complained about Wheeler's criticism, he was invited to resign from his position with the Republican staff of the Senate Budget Committee. He is now a senior fellow and director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Center for Defense Information in Washington, D.C. Winslow Wheeler is also the author of The Wastrels of Defense, How Congress Sabotages U.S. Security. And, of course, famously President Eisenhower's farewell address, he referred to the military-industrial complex. In the original draft, of course, it was the military-industrial congressional complex, and his brother Milton, out of deference to Congress, suggested they take that out. In many ways, in retrospect, it's a pity, because it seems to me that that's the key nexus of all this, isn't it?
Yes, it is. They're all equal partners in the enterprise. It would be a different kind of creature if any one of those parts fell out of the intimate cooperation that the three parts perform with each other.
And Senator McCain is considered somebody that's been critical of the military-industrial complex. At least he was back in 2000 when he was running against George W. Bush. He talked about the Iron Triangle. But his record in many ways speaks otherwise, doesn't it?
Well, that's what I wrote about in that essay in 2002. As a staffer for the Senate Budget Committee, I was sitting in the back of the Senate chamber watching it debate the fiscal 2002 Department of Defense Appropriations Bill. This is just 3 months after the September 11th attacks. And Senator McCain was giving a really great speech about all the garbage Congress had put in that bill. And he was pointing out the ludicrous examples and, you know, giving them a pretty hard time about it. There's about $4 billion worth of pork in that bill. And by today's standards, that's a paltry amount. He gave his speech, and then he sat down. And I signaled to his staff in the back of the room sitting with me, you know, sort of a body motion question, okay, so what now? And he signaled back to me, that's it. What he was telling me was that in a institution specifically designed to help Senator McCain tie the body up into knots, unless he got accommodated to, you know, take some of that pork out, he chose to give a speech about it and then sit on his hands. And that's what got me to write the essay and to characterize Senator McCain not as a pork buster, as he describes himself at his website, but as a pork enabler. He was simply saying to the other senators, I'm going to complain about this. I'm going to give a pretty hot speech about it, but I'm not going to do anything about it. So you don't need to worry about, you know, me, and you can press on, do what you want to do.
It appears that that cost you your position with the Republican staff of the Senate Budget Committee.
Well, I should thank Senator McCain because, yes, he did try to get me fired. I actually technically wasn't fired. I resigned after my boss, Senator Domenici, and I had a little discussion about it. But after I left, my salary went up. I got to write my book. I get to work out of home. And so I should send him a letter of thanks.
Well, let's talk about the story that came out this week and about the Iraq's spending rules being ignored by the Pentagon, particularly in an audit of money that's taxpayer money spent by the United States Army on contractors in Iraq. It seems like out of the $8.2 billion that they audited, about 90% of it is unaccounted for. Some of it outrageously so, $320 million in cash to Iraqi soldiers or a group of Iraqis under some strange category.
Well, the theory is it went to the soldiers. It probably just went to somebody who salted it away in a bank account. The article doesn't make it clear, but it looks pretty foul.
It's under simply a piece of paper that says Iraqi salary payment.
Right.
And apparently they looked into it, and there were only 1,000 individuals involved. So whoever they are, they're getting well paid.
That's right. They're the saddest thing I can say about that article is that it discusses a problem that is decades old. They were addressing there almost literally the frosting on top of the tip of the iceberg. To keep it simple, for decades, the Pentagon has not been flunking audits. It's been inauditable. You flunk an audit when we find out where the money went and it went to the wrong place. You can't, if you are inauditable, we can't find out where the money went. And it's not just the Army spending in Iraq that's the problem. It's the whole thing. In 2006, the DOD, the Department of Defense Inspector General, gave up on trying to track down $2.8 trillion worth of transactions that were inauditable, and it was apparent to them that the accountants that were writing down these transactions in the Department of Defense were sort of forcing the numbers to make them add up to make sense rather than trying to find out who got paid the money, were the goods delivered, and so on. We have a huge problem on our hands. The Defense Department is the worst in the federal government at it. The apologists for it keep on saying, well, it's so big. Give these guys a break. They're warriors. Baloney. There are thousands of civilians who are supposed to be taking care of these things. And the Defense Department is broken up into 68 auditable entities, about half a dozen of which have been able to pass an audit. The other 60 or so are still flat on their back in a state of you know, inauditability. It's a decades-old problem. Neither Republicans nor Democrats have done a thing about it, and it is a huge mess.
Well, it seems, though, that the Iraq war has literally been about pouring money at a problem which we've clearly not solved in any measure, although there seems to be a collective delusion in Washington and in the press that things are going well. You get the distinct impression that this is a quantum leap into, I mean, you can go back in history and go back to the selling tainted beef to the Union right. Army in the Civil War, etc. There's apparently a tradition here of crooked contracting in the military. But this, I'm trying to get to the idea of when you have the spigots open and the money just pouring in without any accounting, is this some kind of backroom way to pay off friends and cronies? Because if you read the books by Tom Ricks, Fiasco and Imperial Life in the Emerald City, mm-hmm. By Chandrasekhar, you get the distinct impression that the Bush and Cheney people just sent over these political operatives who were totally incompetent, and they were just throwing money away. And I'm wondering whether there's some kind of payoff or kickback scheme going on here, or is this pure ad hoc corruption because there's so much money in the trough and all the pigs are welcome to go gobble it up?
Well, I guess my answer is it's both. It's business as normal, business as usual. These kinds of problems were just as prevalent during the Clinton years when we were fighting in Kosovo and Somalia and sending troops to Haiti. The difference today is that there's a different environment surrounding the spending of money. The defense budget has increased in inflation-adjusted dollars by about 45% since President Bush came to office, not counting the additional money appropriated for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We are in a period of giant growth in the defense budget, and we don't have an environment like we did in World War II where there's a sense of adult supervision of how this money is being spent. One of the greatest patriots during World War II, to my way of thinking, was Harry Truman, who started something called the Truman Commission over the bitter objections of the White House back then. And he had a unique ability and willingness to do his homework, do it himself, not rely on his staff to do it, drove around in his own car to visit military facilities and find out what the heck was going on. We don't have that now. We don't have a sense of adult supervision either in the Pentagon or in Congress or to a large extent even in the press. The stories like the one you started out with from the New York Times are pretty rare these days. My guess is that newspapers are afraid of being labeled unpatriotic for questioning these things. To my way of thinking, the best patriots are the ones who do question these things and try to get it straightened out so that the money gets paid to the right people. On your question about, you know, Bush, Cheney, and Halliburton and all of that, it's unmeasurable to say whether it's worse or better now than before, because now and before, the money is untrackable. And so we really don't have a hard answer to your question.
Right, except that there's 40% more money.
Yes, there's more money in the system, right. And so it's a logical inference that there's more greedy hands on that money, but the amounts are unknowable.
So where's the outrage then? I would have thought that hard-pressed American taxpayers who are finding it hard to fill up the gas tanks on their cars and pay their food bills, shouldn't they be kind of ticked off about this?
They sure should be, and you should see a reflection of that in Congress, and you're not. you're seeing the article for the New York Times was based on a New York on a congressional hearing. They had their hearing, they expressed their outrage, and nothing further happened. Sometimes a bill gets introduced. Usually that bill gets punched full of holes and becomes law and doesn't change a thing. The biggest problem, I believe, is a lack of a sense of accountability, that the people who are responsible for these things will be found out, and there'll be penalties for the ones who can't track the money or who are complicit in its misuse, and there'll be rewards and promotions for ones who do track down this money and point out the wrongdoing. We're not operating in that kind of atmosphere these days.
So does this all go back to this notion of privatization? I mean, in for example, in what is now called the prison industrial complex, you have private prisons that are largely unaccountable, and that's a phenomenon that's growing since we have about a quarter of the world's prisoners in our prisons. The idea that you have these that duties and services that the military itself used to take care of are now taken care of by private entities. And there's, of course, the famous sole source no-bid contract awarded to KBR Halliburton for $150 billion for 10 years. Now they're going to break that contract up and share it with DynCorp and Fluor, two other giants.
Right. They're going to carve the pie into three pieces rather than to recompete the contract year after year as they should.
Right. So again, I'm wondering how this whole contracting racket started, and whether anybody's done a study to suggest that you get value for money, given the enormous amount of waste and fraud that's already been exposed.
Well, there's two issues here. There's the issue of contracting out and the issue of following the money. I would feel more comfortable if, you know, even if these things were contracted out, if the auditing trail were clear and followed. That's not occurring. And so we have the worst of both worlds. We have money being spent we don't know how, and we have it being spent by contractors. Sometimes they're performing a government function. Sometimes they're performing a function that reasonably would be contracted out. And as an example, the kinds of things that should never be contracted out but is being contracted out, every 4 years, the Defense Department does something called the Quadrennial Defense Review to chart out its future and figure out what it needs and what it should buy and what the strategies should be and so on. If you can believe it, the Air Force has contracted with a contractor, I forget which one off the top of my head right now, to chart for the Air Force its own future. This is not the kind of thing we should be giving, you know, to contractors to do. That's an inherently government function that the Air Force should be doing, but they think it's just fine to give that job to a contractor.
So, in other words, the entire future of the service is being divined by some outside group.
Well, you know, the contractor will produce a report. The Air Force will look it over and, you know, put its imprimatur on it. There might be some nits and nats changes, but the basic charter is going to be drafted by a contractor.
Well, the Air Force founded the RAND Corporation. It's not as if they don't have something in-house already. That's surprising.
Right, and even the RAND Corporation shouldn't be doing something like this. I mean, the RAND Corporation also is a hired gun for the Air Force.
Of course.
And, you know, there should be people...
It's sort of intellectual decoration for wholesale theft.
Yep.
So, just as we come to the end here, Winslow Wheeler, we're both sort of in dismay about the lack of outrage from the American taxpayer about how much of their hard-earned money is being wasted and unaccounted for, and it's hard to understand how a system that could have developed that doesn't have any built-in accounting And what's your sense of how much this could therefore become a political issue in the campaign, since Senator McCain is running as a reformer? Do you think that Obama is going to talk about this? I mean, it seems to me fairly, it should be political grist for the mill, shouldn't it?
It certainly should be, but I'm not optimistic. The Democrats have been as bad at this as the Republicans. You see some feeble attempts at oversight, such as with Congressman Waxman and his oversight and government reform committee. But if you look at his hearings, what you see is members reading off questions, not particularly listening to the answer, even when they get a ridiculous one, and then they read off the next staff-drafted question. It's pretty pitiful. In the Senate Armed Services Committee, led by Senator Levin from Michigan, the Democrat, the oversight over there is pretty non-existent. Every now and then there's some nibbling gently around the ankles, but certainly nothing serious. And a lot of this stuff keeps on passing through, just as it has in their most recent bill, the Fiscal 2009 Department of Defense Authorization Act. I don't think this is going to change until it does become an issue, and both sides begin to appreciate that the jig is up, and they need to get a little bit more serious about doing the job. The note I'll end on is that the first boss I had on Capitol Hill was a liberal Republican from New York, Jacob Javits. And during my first year with him, he shook a finger at me and said, "Don't ever try to get me to ask a question that you don't know the answer to." So that if he gets a lousy answer, I can work with him on trying to get a better answer out of that witness or to correct the witness. On Capitol Hill these days, you don't get that sense. You get the sense that they're reading off questions, they're reading off statements, they're reading off speeches, and it could be Mickey Mouse sitting there, and they'd read off the next question. We need to be able to change the way people in government agencies on Capitol Hill think about doing the job of oversight.
Well, maybe the heart of the problem is that perhaps we have too many representatives in Washington who represent capital and not people.
Well, if they get the sense in their stomach that their job is going to go down the tube unless they start getting more serious about it, you'll see a big change. But we haven't, you and I haven't been successful yet in changing that feeling in the pit of their stomach. Right now, they're feeling pretty comfortable.
Well, I guess that it comes down to the people marching on Washington, doesn't it? I recall Pat Buchanan some time back when he ran talked about people coming to Washington with their pitchforks.
Well, sometimes you don't need to do that in reality style. But if they begin to get the sense that they're going to see that reaction in the elections or in their campaign contributions, or they're going to have a political opponent who's going to be more serious about these things, that's when you start seeing them react and trying to figure out, okay, now they're on to me. Now I need to figure out how to do my job.
Right. How much effort does it take to send an email? I mean,
that's right.
I thank you so much for joining us, Winslow Wilder.
It's a real pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking then with Winslow Wheeler, who worked on national security issues for 31 years as a member of the U.S. Senate and the U.S. General Accounting Office. And he wrote under a pseudonym an article under the name Spartacus for Congress about Congress's reaction to September 11th and the expending pork larding that was going on. And for that criticism, he was forced to resign from his position with the Republican staff of the Senate Budget Committee. He is now the senior fellow and director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Center for Defense Information in Washington, D.C. I'm now speaking with Leanne Madden, who is a Iraq veteran who just got out of the military in January. He's a co-founder of Appeals for Redress, a way in which individual service members can appeal to their congressional representatives and U.S. senators to urge an end to the U.S. military occupation of Iraq. And he's also on the board of Iraq Vets Against the War. And I noticed essentially there's been a press blackout, at least in the mainstream press, about the Winter Soldiers tour of the country. But a little bit of light was shed by PBS's NewsHour this week, where they did some coverage of a congressional hearing that took place before the House Progressive Caucus, where many Iraq vets testified, and they set it up in such a way where an academic from West Point was asked to look in on what was going on, and surprise, surprise, he said, "Well, you know, these guys seem to be telling the truth. This is a genuine movement. This is not some sort of left-wing political conspiracy, if you will." So, is your sense in any way, Liam, that you're breaking through in your efforts to tell your story?
Absolutely, and I don't necessarily think that has to do with... Well, by the way, thank you for having me on the show. It's
Memorial Day, and we much appreciate having a veteran on this weekend.
I'm glad you see things that way. I appreciate it. Do I feel like we're making grounds in trying to get information about Iraq out there? And I absolutely do. First of all, internally, our movement, at least our organization, Iraq Veterans Against the War, is way more organized, way more cohesive, and we're really forming the relationships and the bonds with each other that I feel is the basis of any movement, is relationships. So on that level, I'm very excited, and that's helped us even... I mean, granted, there wasn't great media coverage, and I completely expected that, but the event itself is out there for people who are interested to see. It's on our website, ivaw.org. It was covered on C-SPAN. It was covered on PBS. And so, I mean, the information is accessible, and that's important, and that was only possible because of the learning that we're doing as a movement. And I think I'm really excited. I've learned a lot in my last year of organizing since I've been in the military and gotten out of the military. And I feel that I'm going to be able to take a lot of these lessons I've learned and turn it into real gains for a movement. And I feel that a movement is the only thing that's going to end this war. It's the only thing that's going to wrest the power in our country away from these maniacs who bring us into war again and again. So I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful because I'm doing a lot of learning, and we're building very, very powerful, meaningful relationships, and we're communicating with people.
So why do you think, Liam, that the American people seem to not to be particularly engaged in the Iraq war, given that $2 trillion of their money has essentially been buried in a hole, 4,080 of their young men and women have died, countless more have both physical and psychological wounds, and yet the only people who are bearing the brunt of President Bush's misadventure are the military themselves and their families. To some extent that's obscene. So how did the general public get so disengaged from the military?
A lot of people would say that the lack of a draft has precluded young people from getting involved. A lot of people would say the fact that those $2 trillion you had just mentioned were not really even coming out of people's pockets. That's money that was not in the national budget. It was borrowed from China. So they're doing everything in their power to avoid people feeling like they have to sacrifice. They don't want people to be involved. I think the media is part and parcel of this. They're completely complicit in selling this war and sanitizing the images and messages we hear about the war every day. So in that sense, that would explain some levels of the... You might call it apathy, but this is the other side of the coin of what I need to say. In the same breath, I need to say that it's not necessarily apathy. A lot of it, a lot of the lack of involvement that you're talking about, I feel, is a powerlessness. People don't agree with the war, but they don't know what to do. They expect the election to come along to elect some savior or whatever, and that's the mechanism that we're taught from a very young age to remedy our grievances. So I think it's not so much a lack of involvement because of apathy or because people just don't care and pay a price. I think a lot has to do with they don't want people to feel like they're involved, and they also they tell people that they're powerless, and I think that's wrong. I think people are going to... We're going to be seeing, relatively speaking, in a short time, people waking up.
Well, that, I think your point's well. I think your point's well taken there. That in fact, the Bush administration have every interest in keeping the American people from being involved, and they want to sanitize it as much as possible, make it seem like things are going well and it's under control. And the press have unfortunately enabled them in doing so. But why aren't the political candidates that are running for president now, who are getting all of the ink and television headlines, why aren't they stepping up to the plate? I mean, people keep saying that pollsters say that the economy in Iraq are the two big issues. Well, I don't see that from both Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John McCain.
Well, My personal opinion is that they're all on the same side. They're not talking about the war in Iraq because their position isn't this is a mistake. Their position is how are we going to do it better? John McCain is very straightforward in saying that, oh, I'm going to win in Iraq. I'm not going to get us out. I'm going to get victory. And Obama and Clinton, for the most part, have the same line as, we're not going to withdraw troops. We're just going to project American power in this region better. So I don't think that's something that gets talked about a lot because that's antithetical to what most Americans really want to see. I mean, if you look at their positions, particularly the ones on the Democratic side, they say things like, we're going to get the troops out of Iraq. But in reality, when you ask them about their plans, it's to leave tens of thousands of troops in Iraq to protect the embassy, to train Iraqi military personnel to fight terrorism, to protect the forces that they already have there, to leave tens of thousands of troops in the region, to not even mention about the 180,000 contractors in Iraq that helped to occupy this country. So I don't think it's in their agenda. I don't think that if they articulated it and talked about it a lot, most Americans wouldn't agree or would see through this fake dichotomy of ending the war or winning the war.
Well, indeed, just on the contractor issue, which we covered with Winslow Wheeler, the Blackwater have got an enormous amount of negative publicity. In spite of that, the State Department renewed their contract. So this contracting thing seems to have a life of its own. As a Marine, former Marine in Iraq, what's the attitude that the service members have about these contractors who seem to be getting rich off this war? When a lot of the soldiers have come back home wounded, with both missing limbs and psychological scars, and they're finding it hard to get proper treatment. So there's obviously when a private contractor, a shooter, gets $1,000 a day, that's pretty obscene in terms of what the regular Marines and Army get paid.
Yeah, I think it's pretty easy for most soldiers and Marines. When I was over there, there was a feeling of a little bitterness and resentment that these guys were making easily three times the amount of money we were making for doing the same job. And I think there is, on a personal level, maybe a little bit of bitterness and resentment, but I think it would be unwise to look at the actual people over there doing the contracting, and it would serve us all better to look at the systemic nature of the companies as a whole who are just gouging the American people, skimming off the money intended for the Iraqi people, and the government that made this whole thing possible with the no-bid contracts that basically tell them the more you spend, the more profit you make. There's absolutely no incentive for these companies like Halliburton, Blackwater, DynCorp, Bechtel to save money. The thing is designed to gouge the American taxpayers.
Well, Leanne, we've run out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us here on this Memorial Day weekend. Leanne Madden, again, co-founder of Appeal for Redress and on the board of the Iraq Vets Against the War. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Bye-bye. Thanks a lot. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Lick Duan, the assistant producer, and Melissa Figueroa, the engineer. Stay tuned.